marital status. Evidence that you are chaste and respectable, that someone wants you and feels you are worthy to be married. Bonus if your husband has a job with stature. Beauty that mimics white features. A fair, light complexion, hair set straight, or mixed girl curly, not kinky, a petite physique. Money and material items. Not necessarily the same as financial security, but a display of luxury goods. Pedigree. Parental or family stature and legacy. 2. Fighting fire with fire. When we react to white supremacist culture, we may literally curse it and give it the finger. This may look like throwing all the respectability politics aside, being seen, and being heard. In this instance, the reasoning may be more about to hell with white people and to hell with what anyone thinks about me. I'll wear what you deem unacceptable, say what I want, how I want, whenever I want, and I'm not hustling to be approved by white standards. We move against shame and may even fight shame with shame. The armor may be toughness and nonconformity. I'm not giving you a chance to reject me because I'm not even trying to be accepted by you. I reject you and all of your expectations before you reject or try to shame me. Here, the motive for being nonconformist and wielding a tough veneer is to cast off shame with anger and defiance. The goal is to cut off expectations of acceptance and connection by intentionally disconnecting and mitigating the feeling of exclusion and being judged. 3. Hiding under the radar. This looks like playing small, not using your voice, avoiding any shine or attention. If I just lie low and mind my business, no one will have anything to say. With this approach, we keep ourselves hidden and quiet. We hide our successes, as they can often make us a target. Many times, Black people are even told, never let them see what you have. The last thing a white person wants to see is a Black person with anything better than they have. We're not supposed to win. We're not supposed to be successful. We're not supposed to be ambitious. And we certainly are not supposed to have more success than white people. Because of this mandate, we use the shame shield of moving away. As with assimilation and fighting fire with fire, this approach fosters disconnect. Furthermore, we never realize our own strength, abilities, and worth. When I separated, very amicably, and moved out of the family house, I had to secure a new place that would accommodate me and my boys. This meant I had to identify as a single Black mother. In Seattle, every landlord or rental agent was white. I was asked if my kids were loud, if there were any custody issues or a restraining order. There was an obvious narrative that these white folks told themselves about me. I was asked again and again about my employer and position. It was like they expected me to switch my story and be caught in a lie. Note that all this information was clear in my rental application. Attorney, six-figure salary, leader at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I always brought a copy of my credit report that reflected a credit score categorized as excellent. And yet, because of this constant shaming and humiliating experience, I gave up on attempting to rent a home and just rented a standard commercial apartment. Shame is often the barrier to wholehearted living. It can confine us on a hamster wheel, always racing for approval and acceptance, hiding our presence, are sapping our energy and efforts to be armored. When we share our stories, practice empathy, and deconstruct the beliefs that induce shame, we become shame resilient. Shame resilience provides the gift of wholehearted living. An extra bonus of shame resilience, dismantling white supremacy. Here are some tools of shame resilience. Deconstruction and naming. Social justice scholars provide language and frameworks that deconstruct white supremacy, patriarchy, transphobia, and other systems of inequity. Standards of intellect, womanhood, and beauty were never inclusive of Black women. Reading the words of Audre Lorde, Kimberly Crenshaw, Paula Giddings, James Baldwin, bell hooks, Sonya Renee Taylor, Ibram X. Kendi, and so many other Black intellectuals provides visibility, affirmation, and historical facts that are rarely taught. Breaking down power and privilege by acquiring language and recognizing shared narratives enables us to see and name inequity and shame. Community and connection. Black women have held one another's pain forever. We have formed connections with a flicker of an eye, a knowing nod, a warm hug, and a slight hand gesture. No words spoken. When we choose to tell our stories and stand in our values, we disempower white supremacy. We expose injustice, we validate our presence, we affirm our existence. The power of a community that sees us and validates our experiences is invaluable. My sister circle, my community of Black women who see me, hear me, and hold me, is my source of infinite empathy, truth-telling, and protection. We encounter the same system that excludes us. We know the shame-inducing narratives. Through it all, we hold one another and share tears and joy, wins and losses. This sister circle that I have is not the first of its kind. It has existed among Black women since the beginning, before white supremacy. It is the love that allows us to thrive despite misogyny, classism, transphobia, and all of the systems that work to annihilate us. Creatives and possibility. J. California Cooper, Octavia Butler, Dorothy Height, Adrienne Marie Brown, Jordan Pill, Anita Baker, Teohodari Coker, Langston Hughes, Sonia Sanchez, Ta-Nehisi Coates, Jason Reynolds, Lena Waithe, Ava DuVernay, Frank Ocean, Beyonce. Our creatives who bring lyrics and rhythm, images and characters, and futures that validate us, create spaces where we thrive and dreams for us to keep dreaming. They provide us spaces to breathe freely that are in this world and beyond this world. Every human spirit needs connection and hope. Spirituality and purpose. There's a space between legacy and ancestry that anchors our existence. Some call it our higher calling, and others refer to it as our higher purpose. It's where we believe and know that despite the systems and hardships, we have a purpose that supersedes the here and now. We recognize that our very existence transcends and defies what we see, are taught, and experience daily. Did I ever smile? Rarely. Instead, I had a perpetual chip on my shoulder. I remember being at a New Year's Eve party and a white girl accidentally shoved me. I lost it. My brother and my cousin, who was visiting from out of town, had to pull me off the girl. I believe I was pretty much going for blood. It was like the straw that broke the camel's back. In college, this was the case as well. I often found myself just being angry. Angry all the time. At Smith College, in a sea of whiteness telling me how wrong I was. Sometimes it was overt, but usually it was 1,000 microaggressions a minute. To deal, I had to fly under the radar or sometimes default to, I don't give a damn, or get the fuck out of my way. We are vulnerable even when we are not. We are vulnerable even when we have not chosen to be. The existence of Black women is always under assault. Our hair is an insult and our bodies are violated. Our Black brothers, sons, fathers, daughters, mothers, sisters, grandmothers, aunties are all vulnerable. We can disappear, be assaulted, be murdered under the color of law without recourse. Despite our credentials and accolades, we can be the first to be laid off. We know this and we are reminded of this. We are always vulnerable, living without certainty and at risk. But to choose to be vulnerable, as in emotionally exposed, that is something we have control over. When and to whom will we show our emotions? we get to choose this. We may expose that we didn't come from a two-parent household, our hair fresh out of braids, or without the perm or wrap, speak in free-flowing colloquial, share our stories and our experiences of fear, joy, grief, and shame, bear our tears and celebrate our wins with our uninhibited laughter. When we are willing to discard armor, we are free, and we free others. Among one another, we may opt to be vulnerable for several reasons. We may simply trust our shared language and journey, or we may be vulnerable in a moment when our pain is too great to bear. I have yet to meet another sister who has not had this moment. The moment you are so numbed until another sister, another brown-skinned girl, hugs you fiercely and gently. Then the tears and the sobs come. You may not even know her name, but you know each other. You see each other and you feel each other's pain. Place and space matter. Being vulnerable in places and spaces where we are not supposed to be, or where our truth has never been spoken and our vulnerability has never been seen, is powerful. Being seen and compelling others to witness the violence of white supremacy invites accountability. It injects truth into a facade. This truth-telling is a powerful step in dismantling white supremacy, putting cracks in it. White women and anyone else with a targeted identity reap the benefits of Black women's willingness to be vulnerable. When we are vulnerable, we are literally breaking chains. In the moments when we are vulnerable in these white spaces through our truth-telling, we're extending an invitation to authenticity and potential connection to those who aren't assaulted by white supremacy in the same way as Black women. We may not be able to control the fact that we are by default vulnerable in this society, in this world, but we can share our narrative on our terms and use it for connection and empowerment instead of hustling for our worth. It was amazing to go back to Israel to trace my family's lineage all the way to the home my great-grandparents lived in, and then to see my family listed in the Book of Names. This was a conversation at a work dinner. We were all women on a shared leadership team, and I was the only person of color. Two of my colleagues were Jewish and shared this pretty amazing history. The other two colleagues began to talk about their families' stories of origin and immigration. I was quiet. Is this where I say that I don't know my lineage? Because, well, you know, the S word? Then I'm left with a few options. None are mutually exclusive. A, be the joy wrecker. B, manage their guilt and awkwardness throughout the meal. Or C, shrug off their defensiveness and disdain. Note that each of these options leaves me even more ostracized and as the one who isn't a good team player. So I order another drink and put on my face of immersed interest. When considering what it takes to get to vulnerability with white people, this differs for each individual. Based on my experience and what has been shared with me, there are themes for when we can trust and venture to be vulnerable. Learner mindset. Engaging with someone who is invested in actively learning for the sake of growing and improving can further relationships with white people. Note that there is a difference between embracing learning for the purpose of establishing a deeper connection and creating positive change, and learning simply to know or to satisfy penchants for voyeurism. We have little desire to be someone's teacher for free or a project topic they are learning about. Evidence of a learner mindset includes active listening, embracing getting something wrong instead of being defensive, and inviting accountability. Acknowledgement of privilege and inequity. White people who understand and own their privilege and the inequity it can yield are easier to be vulnerable with. This should translate into greater self-awareness and therefore showing up differently. Showing up differently includes the white person not exercising power and privilege over us and recognizing impact over intention. Bravery. We cannot conclude because a white person is an active learner who acknowledges their privilege and recognizes inequity that they will also be brave enough to take action or use their voice to counter inequity. Seeing a white person who is a learner, who is actively using their status, privilege, and knowledge to be present and vocal in countering inequity is powerful. These are the people I want in my corner, and they're likely the only white people you'll see at my kitchen table. Yes, I know that the trapdoor of racism is ever present in relationships with white people. Their blind spots will show up. Even if it is not their doing, it can be their family members and other white friends who send you spiraling by pulling that trapdoor of racism open on you. Your expectation is that the white friend or peer will swiftly deal with the situation, even if you have to call their attention to it. After I studied Black women and was immersed in our history and our stories, I saw me. Like, I just saw me. I didn't see me through the lens of whiteness and the stories that are told about me and people who look like me. I saw me. I saw what I'm capable of. I saw that my story started at a deficit because I was reading a narrative written by someone who created a version of me that was twisted and wrong. Seeing more Black women calling out, not calling in, white supremacy when they see it is empowering for all of us. We see this on all platforms of social media now. Sisters are out here saying their piece and not being shy about saying, "I'm speaking." Even if this white supremacist society never agrees to see us on our own terms, we're creating our own spaces. Pulling up a chair to a table setting of white supremacy? No thanks.
Aiko D. Bethea is a perpetual learner. She co-designs blueprints for folks to create mindsets and spaces where they can thrive. Leadership and organizational development are her favorite wheelhouses. Her greatest space for learning and joy is raising Wes and Ben with their dad extraordinaire.
To you, vulnerable mother, a choreo essay, Imani Perry. My life seems to be an increasing revelation of the intimate face of universal struggle. You begin with your family and the kids on the block, and next you open your eyes to what you call your people, and that leads you into land reform, into Black English, into Angola, leads you back to your own bed where you lie by yourself, wondering if you deserve to be peaceful, or trusted, or desired, or left to the freedom of your own unfaltering heart. And the scale shrinks to the size of a skull, your own interior cage. June Jordan, Some of Us Did Not Die, New and Selected Essays. When did you begin to awaken with a swollen face? I mean the one that is not the result of a cold or hours of weeping. The one that is your earned face. Worry makes its mark. If not there, in a steady ache between your shoulder blades, a steady headache, the corn worried to red on white atop your right third toe, you sigh unexpectedly and often. I started this piece with June Jordan, a habit of mine, because she grants me remarkable confidence. And because she could tell a world in a paragraph. The intimate face of the universal struggle blooms when we come of age. We all love, hopefully hard, the kind of love that cannot be destroyed. We fear death. We hate heartbreak. We work too hard and rest too infrequently. Those are near universal things. But it can get more challenging still. Some terms are harder to live with, according to identity, responsibility, and experience. The universal struggle sometimes has a starker and harsher expression. I know that June Jordan was talking to me, a Black woman, worrying about her family and kids and the kids on the block and the people and the prisons. Sometimes, I have read, people use the second person instead of I when they are talking about something that is especially painful because it is less frightening if you distance yourself from it. Perhaps that's what I just did. But I hope that it also works as a way to reach across from me to you, listener. I hope that in the way that the June Jordan words hit me, rang loudly inside my head when I read the words, that when you listen to you, you see you and me, maybe a you and me that both of us find difficult to face and even harder to forget. Vulnerable people, I have read, are defined by being susceptible to physical or emotional attack or injury. If you are a person whose very body marks you as deserving of disregard or as available for violence, you are vulnerable, no matter how strong or smart you are. And so I wonder, why don't we always call being Black in the United States being vulnerable? It is inarguably so. I am a Black mother, and if you are like me, you may have played with doll babies for long hours as a child. You tended them with care. You rocked or shaked the baby, gently soothing in the way you saw your own caretakers do. Sometimes you fussed at your children, but then you picked them up and kissed their plastic cheeks. You sewed dresses with big uneven stitches and regretted cutting off their waxy curls. You never once doubted that your attentiveness and sweet love was more than enough for your babies. Your confidence was remarkable. But you had to grow up. We grew up. And as we grew up and became real mothers, so much was eked away that we grew with each season of life more aware of the precarity of our task. Black mothers' vulnerability is particular. And inside that specific reality, that ambiguous word vulnerable collides against itself, because vulnerable also means that you are subject to higher penalties for every misdeed, every failure. But also, vulnerable means that you need special care and protection because you are susceptible to physical or emotional attack or injury. Here is the tension. If I reveal my anguish, my human errors are exposed, judged, evaluated, and punished, with little hope for sensitivity. Empathy, writ large, is reserved for other types of people, less vulnerable ones. Empathy is often shaped by white supremacy. It glides over us, rarely resting long enough to witness our humanness. I'll tell you a few stories to make things clearer. Once upon a time, there was a mother and a child. The mother read stories to her son each night. She gave him plenty of hugs and warm baths. She joined the PTA when he began school. It was that year that his breathing became labored, strained, terrifyingly vulnerable. The big stone schoolhouse was a sick building. Poison radiated from it, because who cares much about schools for children like him? And she would run from work every time he struggled, and she missed work and was punished, then fired, for tardiness and absences, and he missed school and faced the consequence for tardiness and absences. And when they weren't around, the people talked about what a shame it was that neither fulfilled their promise. And soon there were so many things to worry about that the nighttime stories had no magic and were set aside, and the hugs grew rare, feeling desperate rather than sweet. Once upon a time, there was a mother and a child. The mother had scaled every professional height. She kept things precise. Excellence was her brand and promotion. The daughter was smart and gregarious and the apple of her mother's eye, but too much for a Black girl in the eyes of many. Pricks of envy turned to sniping. The girl grew embarrassed, How could she tell her mother so precise how much she was failing at staying in her place? Loneliness stuck in her craw. Ugliness stared back at her from the mirror in their eyes. Soon her spirit was cracked. The mother watched, castigated, encouraged, implored, until she too began to see failure in the mirror. The one thing that mattered most was her greatest inadequacy, motherhood. Once upon a time, there was a mother who slipped away in mind but not body. There was a child who tried to mother her. The child cooked, the child cleaned, the child adored. The mother, having been hungry her whole life, ate at the child's life, grateful but selfish. The child, hungry her whole life, looked for someone, anyone, to hear their loneliest of songs. You can find them now, swimming upstream against the tide of neglect, with hope waning, but hoping still. Maybe you felt the stories, or you've heard their melodies. Caged birds sing the most beautiful songs. Paul Laurence Dunbar told us so. But they also pace and peck, watch them. Sometimes their habits look frenetic. Sometimes they are so still you wonder, do animals get bored? Or is that bird still alive? A jolt and they startle, like you do when you have a terrible flashback. Some might think the caged bird sings because it has the gift of transcendence, or simply because it is beautiful. Grace is a truer word. Grace is not, however, enough, even when it has to be enough. I mean, really, we can praise it all we want, but will somebody, anybody, open the door? Inside my own interior cage, the one June Jordan told me about, I peer at my swollen face. I feel around for my heart. Underneath the racing, it often aches. There is so much to be concerned with, so much beyond control, so much that is worrisome, so much that cannot be changed. Vulnerable parents raise vulnerable children. Children who step out from under our embrace and face the slings and arrows without us. They are pierced. They have watched us and learned to cleverly cover over wounds, to laugh or lash at them, because vulnerable means subject to higher penalties or deserving of disregard. Weak is something we curl up our lips at. What a terrible thing to do when nurture is the appropriate response. And what a lesson to our young. If they learn that lesson too well, we teach them how not to ask when they need help, and therefore we cannot give them the special care and protection they need and deserve, because they too are vulnerable, masquerading as invulnerable. What a cruel choreography. The sociologists and social critics, not all, but many, will tell you about cycles that must be broken. They mean the sociological things like poverty, prison, employment, disease, premature birth and death, violence, and homelessness. And they will tell you that breaking the cycle is our duty, especially the duty of mothers. And they never flinch or hesitate or let their mouths tremble before the ugliness spilling out of them. They never ask themselves, how is it that I keep telling the vulnerable to not be vulnerable? How is it that I fasten my eyes to write down even more judgment on top of judgment and will not acknowledge the mounds on her back that threaten to bury her? Even seeds need water and air that can be reached. The sharply worded assessment is written again and again. Black women have too much, more than anyone else, cancer, heart disease, and diabetes. Black women have strokes, chlamydia, syphilis, HIV, and hypertension. They give birth to babies who weigh too little and die too frequently, more than anyone else. The data say we die more than other women from the worst of these. The data say we and our children carry too much flesh and too much fat. I hate these statistics. I hate that they're real evidence. But what I hate even more is that they are so often presented without context. And by context, I mean the culture and values that shape our lives. They are, in fact, secondary details to a primary truth about the world and the way it treats us. I would like another set of facts. I would like a visual constellation of the thousands of stressors electrifying our brains each day. I would like a map of the mundane experience of defeat in love, in work, in housing, in caretaking. I would like a list of obstacles before us. I would like someone to draw us standing before the mountain, barefoot, slew-footed, and sleep-deprived, expected to climb. I want a more honest rendering. I want gentle eyes. That is a first step. I have no pep talk to offer because such words only crush you when they falter. You can do it, right before you couldn't. I have felt the crush myself. Instead, my words to myself and to us, to you, are tenderness, warning, and warming. You simply cannot be kind to yourself and also accept the structure and judgment of a racist and sexist society. These days, you hear a lot of talk about self-care. I'm telling you that there is an indispensable tool, a necessary part of self-care that cannot be left out. The tool is refusing to accept the terms of a world that builds you into it as vulnerable. And that goes for parenting and protecting as well. We can bemoan what we don't have. We can and should decry what is unfair and what hurts. But the moment we turn on ourselves, we have chosen cruelty over love. As we prepare our children for this world, our challenging task sits at the crossroads of a vulnerability that we ourselves never get to stop managing. We know the risks of sharing our tears, of admitting weakness. We also know, or ought to know, that if we prepare our children with that lesson, we are teaching them to beat their chests when weeping is more appropriate, to swallow fear when screaming is necessary. And even if we never say it, our examples can be violent. Letting them be fully human can be scary, but it is necessary. Letting ourselves be fully human feels like it's against the rules. I kindly say in response, fuck the rules, be free. I think, and I say think because I will not pretend to know a world that doesn't yet exist, that the lesson we have to teach ourselves is how to do caretaking without denying our vulnerability and even our weaknesses and fallibility. This is what I take Jordan to mean when she speaks of revelation. We have to be naked with our failures and shame, and ask our loved ones to help us stand up and grow through them. And this task is probably hardest when it comes to our children's vulnerability. It tears at us. If you've ever seen a mother lash out at a child, you've probably seen a mother who is convulsing with self-loathing over having to stand before her child inadequate. You've probably seen a mother who has chosen to wound rather than be naked because she thinks that is what the child needs. If you've seen a mother layering thick guilt onto her child's spirit, I think you've probably seen a mother who is terrified that her failure has cost her the greatest love of her life, the one from her child. If that mother is you, you're not alone. If that mother sees you seeing her, show her another way. Build something else with her. easier said than done. Anyone who has been through therapy knows that feeling at the end of the 50 minutes when your life stands in tatters spread out everywhere, and you are charged with walking out and back into regular life. It is terrifying. As much as the discipline of therapeutic practice has its virtues, the vulnerability of exposure is real. We need more than the 50 minutes. We also need daily ritual. We need held hands. We need common purpose. We need a cloud of loving witnesses. For you, for your babies, for me, for mine. Someone must share not only the burden but also the climb. You know how it says in the Bible, where two or more are gathered? I do not believe that this is a statement that is solely or even primarily about church. I believe it is about the essential spiritual requirement of community. When you stand in community, you begin with the basic question, who am I? That's as fraught and dangerous a task as anything else for a vulnerable woman. Can you define yourself in ways that have little, if anything, to do with how you're placed in society, but everything to do with what you like, who you love, what makes you laugh, what rocks your spirit, what leaves you satisfied? Can you notice your feelings without judgment? Can you use them just as information without layering on evaluation? Can you think about the things that make you and your loved ones, especially your children, beautiful, sweet, joyful, without putting them in comparison to others? Can you decide this all matters? Can we? Please. Together. In this task, you let go. You let go of the trivial things that you believe offer you an advantage in this world, and of the big things that threaten to swallow you up. Those sizes are not my judgment, but our doing. I didn't make up the habits. I'm just calling it how I see it. Risky business, I know, but there's risk in every virtue. Let's risk together. This is what Tarana Burke, my friend and our editor, taught me, that the way to risk enough to share that intimate face of universal truth is to risk together. Where two or more are gathered, the moments of plaintive moaning are backed by a melody. Breaks in the tune are what we call in Black music worrying the line. Worrying the line is a phrase for when the expected tune is disrupted. Sometimes the worrying break is a holler. Sometimes it's a shout. Sometimes it reaches toward the sky, and sometimes it is heavy and full-bodied. June Jordan said that there are two ways to worry words. One is hoping for the greatest possible beauty in what is created. The other is to tell the truth. I choose to give over my worrying to this kind that we need. Not a vanity and not a judgment. If you shout, I plan to come running and not alone. I plan to pry apart the gates of that interior cage and grab you up into an embrace. Me too. For me too.
Imani Perry is a professor at Princeton University and the author of 6 books, including the award-winning titles Looking for Lorraine, The Radiant and Radical Life of Lorraine Hansberry, and May We Forever Stand, A History of the Black National Anthem. Her most recent is Breathe, A Letter to My Sons.
Where the Truth Rests, written and read by Tarana Burke. Dear Tarana, take a breath, dear heart. I know you. I don't want you to overwhelm yourself with what I'm about to say. So I want you to stop, breathe, and relax. And keep coming back to this whenever you need to as we move forward. Agreed? Good. It has become increasingly popular to pen letters to our younger selves as a means of healing old wounds and prompting empathy and forgiveness for ourselves that we perhaps couldn't muster at the onset of our trauma. I've employed this practice myself in my work over the years. But I'm going to take a chance and go in a different direction this time by writing to us in the future. I don't know when exactly. This may just be a salve one day when we need it more than any previous day. Or it may be a routine elixir that we pull out often to beat back that all-consuming tidal wave that makes us feel diseased. These are our words to use how we see fit. We are sick. I just need to get that out first, because I know how it makes you feel to hear it or read it. You will want to bucket this characterization or dissect and explain, but I need you to sit with it for a moment. No one is here but us. No one can hear you. No one is judging you. That word, sick, alone, won't kill you. But you have to know in this moment, as I am sending you these words, we are in danger of spilling out of the container that we have spent so much time carefully building for ourselves. Remember when we first started? Oh, we thought we were so clever, didn't we? And we were, to some extent. We were right that no one wanted to hold the weight of what we were carrying in our little first grade hands. They wanted a good girl and a smart girl. So we gave them what they wanted and put those heavy things like fear and shame and confusion in our small box so that we could take it out when no one was looking. It was brilliant until the box started getting full and then got too heavy. And so we started to build new ones. This is where the sickness started, beloved. I know our memories sometimes won't carry us back that far, but you have to know that is because we refuse to step into the container with both feet. Recently, though, I've had to, for both our sakes. As soon as I entered, boxes started falling off of the shelves into my hands. Remember that sleepover? There weren't many in our childhood. We were 7, and it was probably summertime. We begged Mommy to let us spend the night with our neighbor upstairs and her daughter, who was our best friend at the time. As we were going to bed, our friend's daddy asked us for a goodnight kiss. We knew him well, but the pee still shot into our bladder, beating hard against our little pelvis. Our breathing got uneven and our heart was racing. Instead of running into his open arms, we ran into the bathroom, almost missing the toilet bowl from trying to get our pajama pants off so fast. When we were done, we just sat there with our legs dangling over the commode, letting the cold press deep into our calves so that we wouldn't fall over from the toilet seat. We felt a rush of things that we didn't like. Some we knew already, like the shame and fear, and others were new, like the anxiousness and embarrassment. But all of it went into the container. Remember how our stomach turned when our neighbor knocked on the door and then peeked in to see if we were okay? We were very much not okay. But we left the bathroom and forced our little body to run to him and plant a kiss on his cheek anyway. Mommy had to come upstairs and get us that night, because we wouldn't stop crying under the covers after we were all tucked in. The adults said we were afraid of sleeping in new places. We didn't tell them that we were afraid because we were always afraid. I know we haven't thought of that night in a very long time, but please trust me when I say that having a clear understanding of the roots of this illness will go a long way to helping us manage it well. By middle school, we had become so skilled at expanding the container and carefully, neatly packing our stuff inside that it didn't occur to us that we would have any use for those things. So we stopped pulling them out, even when no one was looking. We so desperately wanted to become what we were pretending to be. Remember how harshly we treated ourselves? In the seventh grade, when we were selected to deliver the liturgy during all school mass, we were so excited on the outside and terrified on the inside. We would have to pray and lead the entire school through the call and response. We had never really spoken in public, besides running our mouth in the schoolyard at recess. And now we had allowed our performance of perfection, including that bubbly, outgoing personality, to push us into a real-life performance that we were not ready for. When the time came, even though we had rehearsed, prepped, and done all the things we could to prepare for when we had to show up more closely to authentic, we failed. The memory of standing in that pulpit, staring out at everyone in the school, from the restless kindergarten kids to the irritated and then mildly amused eighth grade kids, and then being able to speak only barely above a whisper, stammering through a prayer we knew backward and forward, followed by an uncontrollable attack of nervous laughter, was a reoccurring nightmare for so many years. I'm sure remembering that long run from the pulpit, down the corridor, and out the massive church doors still makes your stomach knot up and the hair stand up on the back of your neck. That's what is happening to me now. But we have to remember, because what happened at our neighbor's house the night of the sleepover and in the church that day and so many times in between and after was an anxiety attack. I know we are more than familiar with them now, but they didn't start in our 20s as we had long told ourselves. They just got worse then. Children are resilient, and maybe that's why we were able to mask these attacks most of the time. But children are also porous and soak up all the messages spoken and unspoken that surround them on a daily basis. At the time, the whispers to keep silent and appear normal were deafening. And so we did. There is no blame here. We were just trying to survive. The container started to show signs that it would not always hold up on that day in the church. We messed up the liturgy in front of the whole school and were hurt and embarrassed. But our brain had already taught us to turn that into anxiety and shame. That same cycle has repeated over and over so many times in our life that we almost don't know how to function without them. Almost. I know you recall the first time we heard the word anxiety related to our behavior. We were around 22, riding back to Selma from Birmingham with girlfriends. I still don't know where it came from, but out of nowhere, one of our episodes started. We had come up with that name to describe the tightening in our chest, labored breathing, and dizzy feeling that sometimes snuck up on us. Normally, it was like that movie, The Blob, where an amorphous, icky feeling slowly took hold of us and wouldn't relent. It sometimes started in our feet and made our legs feel like jelly as it crept up past our knees to our thighs. Other times, it attacked from our stomachs and spread both ways like a giant burst. But we were masters. We had gotten so good at removing ourselves from people as soon as the first feeling hit, that I bet if we could have watched ourselves, it would have been like seeing a master illusionist at work. That day in the car was different. We had nowhere to go, and we couldn't hide. And so we had to feel all of our feelings in front of folks for the first time. One of our girlfriends opened the window to make sure we were getting fresh air, while the other put her arm around us and talked us through steadying our breathing. She kept us cradled in her arms until our breathing normalized and the car stopped spinning. When they asked us if we were all right, we said it was just a thing that happens sometimes when we have been in the car for too long. But thankfully, our girlfriend knew better. She said very carefully, "I think you had an anxiety attack." She then described what they were and the possible causes, and we nodded and smiled. But even listening to her turn our episodes into a concrete thing with a name was causing us more anxiety. We probably made a joke to brush it off and change the subject. We do that a lot. Do you still do that? We promised that day that we would talk to our doctor about it, but we didn't. We found space in the container and tucked that episode away with everything else. This pattern went on for far longer than we ever want to admit, Tarana. But you remember what happened when we were forced to pay attention. It was during Hurricane Katrina. We had been working for 3 days straight setting up the temporary shelter with our folks and trying to locate our family and friends who had gotten caught in the storm down in New Orleans. We would get up in the morning and go to the Red Cross to check in for new people needing lodging, and then go across the river to our community center, which had been transformed into a holding center for donations. We'd work there for hours, and then drive 23 miles round trip bringing stuff out to the campsite that was now a shelter. We were exhausted. The work itself was keeping us calm, or so we thought, but it was just holding us together. Nothing going on inside of us was calm, because our heart was heavy waiting on news about if our folks had survived or not. Finally, on the third day, we got a call. In so many ways, that call changed our lives. Someone put a cell phone into our hand while screaming and crying out, "It's Uncle Ted!" We grabbed the phone and tried to hold our composure while listening to him rattle off scattered details. The tears were falling hard to the point of blurring our vision. We handed the phone back and attempted to pull ourselves together, but our head was spinning. Before we could make a move, our weight shifted and we grabbed onto the window of the minivan we were leaning on. "Are you okay?" we could hear someone ask, but we were paralyzed, or at least it felt that way. And then we blacked out. When we came to, we acted awful. People were fussing over us, and we started cussing and screaming for them to get off of us, and we went and sat in the building for a moment. After drinking water and sitting still for maybe 10 minutes, we emerged from the building and shot daggers at anyone who asked what happened. We moved on as if it were nothing, and it was such a busy time that no one followed up or asked any more questions. I wish they would have. I wish someone would have pushed us to explain why we were acting so irrational when people were just offering help. I wish someone could have seen through that hard-as-nails exterior to help us see that we had just experienced something we had never quite felt before. A tear in the seam. It was so scary to us because we were not supposed to be this person. The container was supposed to hold. We were not crazy. We were strong. We never, ever fell apart in public. In fact, we went to great lengths to be even keeled in most situations. The only emotions we wielded freely were our versions of happiness and anger. Fear, panic, sadness, vulnerability, and the like were off limits. We had heard our mother say enough times how she hated when women cried in public to know better than to let ourselves get caught in that weak woman web. The need to manage the array of emotions that visited us on a regular basis was predicated on our need to be strong at all times. Strong women are collected. They are sharp and aware and impervious. That moment at the car, as we recovered and folks were fussing over us, we felt overwhelmed and scared. But more than anything, we felt betrayed by our brain. We had done so much work to neatly pack so much stuff away, and in one moment, it seemed to have all come undone. That's where we are today. Undone. I know you want to know why I am dredging up all of these memories that we work so hard to keep just out of our periphery, but I have to. I am worried about us. Therapy got us out of the darkest places, and I am grateful for that. The books we read and the people we have talked to have helped us master the language of healing and healthy, but we know what's true. Breathe. Let your heart collect itself. We aren't in any danger right now. What's true is that we still grind our teeth in our sleep 3 decades after a dentist first told us that it could be a problem. Now it's a problem. We paid handsomely to fix the problem, but how long did we wear the mouth guard? The moment the dentist said it was necessary, our first thought was, I'm not doing that. We are so stubborn. The first doctor we trusted with a few of our secrets was Dr. Pena, our obstetrician. We were most committed to our mental and physical health when we were pregnant. We told him about all of the manifestations of stress and anxiety in our lives and how they mostly affected our sleep, night terrors, teeth grinding, sleepwalking, talking in our sleep, and of course, insomnia. He is the one who first told us the body and mind are connected and suggested a therapist. We stared at the phone number he gave us for a long time until the piece of paper it was on became a grocery list or scratch pad or something. We made a bold promise that we would prioritize dealing with these issues so that we didn't pass them down to our baby. That didn't happen. Right now, we have learned that we have 5 cavities. After a lifetime of none, we now have a mouthful because we have ground down the ridges that protect the teeth. We have damaged our gums and our jawbone from biting down so hard. We were mortified as the dentist gently explained the condition of our mouth to us and asked, are you stressed? Are we stressed still? We once wrote an essay called Death to the Strong Black Woman. It was one of our first published pieces, and we were so worried about it that we stayed up until the wee hours of the morning to make edits and more edits. When the editor asked us if we could add another piece about love and relationships, we agreed, though we were already exhausted. We got that second piece done in one night because we were determined to be excellent. I don't know how we missed the connection between strength and excellence. Do you get it now? I know you probably still call yourself a freedom fighter, but I wonder if you have mapped out a path to your own liberation. Black excellence, strong Black woman, thank a Black woman, Black girl magic. They are all about our labor, not our liberation. We will die on the vine for them if we don't stop and realize that we are sick. Can we talk about the stroke? I don't know how long it's been for you, but for me, it's been less than a year. 3 years into our newfound celebrity, this seemingly random medical emergency was what finally halted us in our tracks. This was supposed to be our tipping point. It was supposed to be the thing that turned us around. It was our undoing. That day was no busier than others. Even though we were quarantined in a pandemic, our work had somehow doubled. We had our usual meetings and Zoom calls and a full agenda, but we were tired. No, exhausted by midday. It was a different kind of exhaustion, though. Extremely low energy and spirits. By early evening, we did the thing we always threatened to do. We lay down for a nap. An hour later, panic woke us up. Our body felt as though we had been in a fight. Our right side couldn't move. We managed to call out to Kaya, who called our fiance into the room. But I want to back up for a moment and recall with you the moment right before they entered the room. We were lying still on the bed, muffling our cries. Every attempt to lift our right arm or roll to our side failed, and each try made our heart race faster. After the second try, we thought about calling out, but instead closed our eyes and attempted to calm down. It is the method we had been using for years during anxiety attacks and those dizzy spells we had decided were vertigo, when no doctor could or would explain them. It wasn't working. The tears were coming faster, and we were scared. We still didn't call out. We lay there for minutes, what could have been precious minutes, thinking. We had one burning question at the moment. What will be exposed if I let this play out? Then our mind was off to the races. What if this was low iron? We thought about how we let our diet go so badly that we had gained at least 20 pounds. What if it was some major anxiety attack? Would they have to medicate me? What if it was that secret compulsion I had? Would the world dismiss me as crazy? What about all the work I had done and still had to do? What happens to that if I let this happen? We didn't even know what this was, but it was different from anything we had felt before. We couldn't calm it down or get our head around it at all. And so finally we called out. An overnight hospital stay, CT scans, MRIs, EKGs, and several blood tests later, we found out that what was diagnosed as a transient ischemic attack, TIA, or mild stroke caused by stress, was actually a condition, complex migraines. Just like the sleep issues, skin issues, stomach issues, hair issues, and dental issues before it, the diagnosis was still stress and anxiety. I'm writing to you right now because if you haven't changed by now, I'm afraid of what else might have been added to this list. And if you have changed only a bit, I'm afraid that this unraveling will only pick up pace if the change isn't drastic. Remember what our neurologist said? We picked her specifically because she was a Black woman and the best in her field, and because we knew she would tell us the truth. And she did. Her exact words, "If you want to live, you need to make a drastic change in your life." Drastic. Has that happened? Have you at least told someone else the truth? The container is beyond capacity, and we clearly can't hold all of this truth on our own. We will succumb to it if we try. The truth always needs a resting place, or it will lie down wherever it sees fit. I'm not trying to guilt you. I know guilt causes us more stress. I'm trying to love on you, love on us. It's so hard for me to do in the present, but I love what our future holds, and I love you, and I want it all for you. You deserve it. We have said these words to so many Black girls over the years, but now I want to say them to you. You deserve safety. You deserve protection. You deserve love. You deserve peace. Breathe, beloved. Let's do it together. Right now. Breathe in what I'm saying. Breathe out what you are thinking. We tell the world they don't have to be anything but themselves to be worthy, and then we work until the stress is about to kill us to prove our worth. It's not just you. It's the paradox of deeply melanated women. But right now, I need you to hear me, because if we are still alive, then there is hope to beat this thing. I will do my part from where I am. That's the commitment I will make to you. I'm going to start by releasing my fear of the container and beginning to clear it out carefully. I will rest where the truth rests, and I won't do it in silence or in secret. I promise. And by the way, if you have done this work already and figured out how to save us, then I just want to say thank you. I knew we could do it. With all my love, Tarana.
This is Bonnie Turpin. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of You Are Your Best Thing, Vulnerability, Shame Resilience, and the Black Experience. Edited by Tarana Burke and Brené Brown. Featuring Tarana Burke, Brené Brown, Jason Reynolds, Austin Channing Brown, Tanya Denise Fields, J.D. Jackson, who read My Head is a Part of My Body and Other Notes on Crazy by Kiese Makeba-Lehman, Prentice Hemphill, Tracy Michelle Lewis-Jiggets, Mark Lamont Hill, Bonnie Turpin, who read We Are Human Too by Kia Brown. Lovey Ajayi Jones. Myron Willis, who read The Blues of Vulnerability by Sean A. Ginwright. Kaya Nadira, Duran Young, Sonia Renee Taylor, Irene Antonia Diane Reese, Yolo Akili Robinson, L. Morgan Lee, who read Hurt People, Hurt People by Laverne Cox, Jessica J. Williams, Aiko D. Bethia, and Imani Perry. This program was directed by Simone Barros, Jessica Kay, Lewis Milgram, Olivia McKenzie Smith, and Scott Sherritt. Executive producer, Karen Jakonski. Edited by Tim Bader Audio. Compilation copyright 2021 by Tarana Burke and Brené Brown. Production copyright 2021, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.